Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jules, I want to get your thoughts and opinions on one specific thing which has dominated my week. Do you play video games with the big light on?
Oh, you've already asked me this question, man. You came to me in the middle of the week and Josh was there like, here, listen, he's about to ask you some crazy stuff. So just humour him. Humour the old man here. I mean, so you told
You're
me
older than
before...
Me.
Ah, that's not true, is it? It's not true. The internet records are dubious at best. Yeah, I am actually. You said that you've been playing your entire life, your entire gaming career with the big light on.
Yeah.
And Josh and I were like, no, no, no. Ambient lighting all the way. No exceptions. No substitutes.
But
what have you been doing? Why? Why have you had the big light on?
When did everyone get the memo that we switched over from like full
the
light?
The moment that we had the choice of a light switch, man. Like, I don't understand.
I was trying to go back in time. I was like, okay, why do I have this? The thing is, it's a stupid thing to realize because I was like, yeah, it gets dark during the day. You put the light on. I didn't think of it beyond that. And then everyone's like, oh, you don't want to be doing that. You want to put the ambient light on. So I was thinking, like, what is my relationship to light?
An easy way to explain why we do that is because video games are, and it has been clarified as such for a long, long time, they are cinematic experiences, Scott.
Yep.
And what do you do when you're at the cinema? Everything bar the central source of light is blocked out from you. As an audience member, you sit there and you are enveloped by the TV's warming glow, glowy warmness.
Uh-huh.
And
I'm watching movies, I'm watching TV, I'm watching everything with a big light on. I mean, not anymore.
That blows my mind to sit there and Kerry and I sometimes watch TV in the front room and it's like we say turn the biggie off. The biggie has to go off when the TV is on because it's just about ambience. It's about setting the mood. The big light is called as such because it's aggressive. It's there. It's a portable sun that you've taken with you and it's just like, hello mate, I'm going to highlight all your flaws.
If you thought that
you were going to get arrest from the oppressive nature of the world. Wrong.
Like having a torch being shone in your face. I just sort of had it on. I didn't think about it. I haven't thought about it in 33 years. And then me and Josh talked about it. I asked you about it. I put a Twitter poll out. Everyone was like, what the living hell are you doing? 90% of 1,000 people.
No, there were some absolute mad eds that agreed with you the big light. And I was like, what is going on with these people? Do they live in that? What's that place where it's like, is it Nova Scotia? Where it's like the nights 25 hours long or something like that. are they the people that are there? Just go, we just need as much light as we can get. We have literally got translucent skin because we've got no vitamin D coming in from the sun.
But the thing is, like I said, I was trying to think of like, okay, if this is something that I just missed the memo on or just whatever, everyone just started doing this. I was like, well, I went back to my parents. I was like, well, I guess, you know, they used to have the big light on when I was a kid. We watched movies and the light would just be on. We weren't sitting in the darkness. But I messaged my mum and I was just like, okay, mum, this thing's happened at work, big light. Do you guys still have the big light on?
This thing's happened at work. She's probably immediately just going like, she's like sweating bullets. Like, oh no, what's happened to my son? What's going on there? My little baby boy. And then you're just like, the big light question.
The big
like,
light discourse.
Throwing the phone out the window.
So I like, asked her, what's going on? Like, did you guys, you know, remember when you started just putting the big light on at tea time? She's like, we don't do that. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, oh, we don't put the big light on anymore. She's like, we just watch it ambient, we put some lamps on. I was like, when did everyone get told this? When did everyone just realise this? My parents didn't even tell me.
Your mum's done you dirty.
I know.
She's instilled that living ideal in your mind, and then she's just said, didn't do that. She's literally gaslit you in this sense.
Well, we did do it when I was younger, but somewhere along the way, my parents also embraced the ambience, and I didn't do this. I've been living the big light life for my entire lifetime.
But there is another guilty party. party in this. Yeah, there is not. Who's, yeah. Why has your wife not said anything?
Well, she thought she was exactly the same as me, which I guess proves that she's the one.
No way. There's no way that in the random chance of rolling a D1000 that you both come up 1,000 on that of the two people in this world that both grew up in parentages that had the big light on.
But that's the thing. We literally did. I went to her going like, hey, I don't know if you've seen the discourse online, my dear, but a lot of things have changed in regards to the way our relationship to light. And she was like, what do you mean? And we spent the entire night driving around buying some ambient lights. I've sorted it now, Jules. I've sorted it. But me and her had no idea. There,
I thought that you were going to say that you were driving around looking through people's windows and seeing what set they have.
They've got a red one in there. They've got a blue one in there.
You're just there in the bush, like the little leaf in front of your face. Just like, look at him. He's got the big light on. He's one of you, like knocking on the window. And the guy looks at you and he's like, oh, they can see me because the big light's on.
Join my cause. And people who are respecting the big light.
I said to you that it's also a safety feature as well, didn't I? I said to you. Because, right, okay, think about this, mate. Think about this, and the audience can mull on this as well, right? Mm. If there is, say there's like a little peeper creeper outside your house and you've got the big light on and you're just relaxing in your front room, right? They can see in, they can see you. They've got a clear view, but they can also see the type of life that you're living, be it good, be it bad. If you're a wealthy person, mate, they're looking at their eyeing it up going like, oh, I might break into that house. That's the one. That's
not
me. But then they go to my house, right? Mm-hmm. With the ambient lighting in. They're like, they can't even afford to have the lights on. They're like literally, they're lighting candles like in the Victorian age. I'm not going to bother them. They're fine.
That whole thing of having a living room on the front of a street and then having the light on so everyone just, like you're on display, like you're at a museum. I always hated that. Like our living room is at the back because I'm just like, get me away from human eyes.
Do you think that we do that literally because the house was designed to basically be the status of wealth, to show people? It's basically like the glass windows and stuff weren't necessarily to let light in. It was to allow other people to view into your life and be like, oh, God, wow, really? Look how rich and amazing I am.
Because I mean, people do that.
Architecturally, why don't we have our lounges, our living rooms in the back of the house with with windows there, but they're on in your garden where no one's looking in at you?
Well, that makes the most sense, right? That's what we have, even though when we got the house, I mean, lucky enough to even have a house, it's been able to afford it over generations of wealth passed down. But yeah, we just moved everything around because the way that they had everything set up when we got it was that the house was on the front. And I was like, I'm not living in full view of the populace. I just moved everything around. So we're living that particular dream, which I would encourage other people to do. But I just thought I'd ask you about the old big light, because when I asked it at the start of the week, I didn't realize just how I was in the bottom 10th of people. 10% of people putting the big light on. I've joined
the
your
percentiles went against you right there, mate. They absolutely had your trousers and your school lunch for dinner, mate. But the thing is, I'm glad that you're evolving as a person. I'm glad that you're learning, because now you've actually gone a step above where I'm even at. You've catapulted yourself. This is the hummus situation all over again, mate. For people who don't know, by the way, welcome to the UBP.
Yes.
But also, there was a time and place where Scott legitimately went up to me, and this isn't me bagging on you, mate. I'm so happy that you did this. You came up to me while we were at the What Culture offices back up in Gateshead, and you said, mate, have you heard of hummus? And I was like, bro, I'm at this point when you told me, I was like 32. I was like, of course I've heard of hummus, mate. It's kind of a big part of my entire lifetime. But you had only just experienced it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I put it in my wedding acceptance speech. I was talking about all the things that my wife's brought to my life, and I was like, I've discovered hummus. There's a whole thing.
But this is what I love about you, is that you're a guy who's willing to try all these new things, and you learn and you grow, and now you catapult yourself, because you went hummus crazy, mate.
I did. You were
mashing chickpeas like there was no tomorrow. But this is the same thing. You've now gone beyond me, because I'm just at the point where I've got the big light off, I've got a little salt lamp on and maybe some candles on, depending if Kerry's feeling spicy. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that you've gone one step further and you've got ambient lights for the back of your TV.
Yeah.
So now you've turned your TV into its own feature piece. So I'm behind you now. I'm behind you.
I didn't even know. And we're not sponsored by them. I think I mentioned this the other day because I was so blown away by the fact you can get Bluetooth light bulbs. You can get smart lights. I don't know how many people know about these things, but you can use an app and you can change the color. And I was like, I don't have to buy another light bulb again. So I just bought a couple of them, and then
some of them are so good as well, because it's like I saw somebody playing God of War Ragnarok with them on, and it's just amazing how the color spill onto the wall behind them, because I think he had like a cream wall, so it really highlighted the color difference. Mm. And I was like, man, that looks good, because it's like an interactive piece that looks like it can't be contained by the TV. It is so superfluous in the bigger scheme of life, where you're just like, oh, what have you spent your day doing? Earning enough to buy some bloody Bluetooth lights. But in that moment, in that time, Big light off, ambient lights on. Let's go.
Yeah, man. Horror stuff like Dead Space looks incredible. So, and the Demon Slayer game looks incredible. I know everybody knows this because, like I said, 90% of people were just like, oh my God, what are you doing? But still, I've seen the literal light and I've now bought some colored lights and I'm there. I'm with you. I've joined the populace.
Let me just kick things off, though, mate.
Okay.
Let me just kick things off because you've had that. We've wasted... Oh, I always say wasted.
A little seminar.
A little seminar for the UBP, we'll start with a question from a Christian Kin over on Instagram, who messaged me saying, best PS1 trilogy. Now, we can only choose one of the three that they have suggested.
Okay.
I'm sorry, four. Spyro, Tomb Raider, Crash... Mm-hmm. Or Gex the Gecko.
It's easily Crash, and I love Spyro.
Is it easily?
I would say it's easily Crash. The trajectory of all three of those Crash games, you can just give to someone right now and they'd love them. I feel like a lot of people have a weird relationship with Crash 3, but because of how mini gamey it is. But like, I love 3.
Weird relationship with Crash 1 as well for some people because they don't like how it's the Dark Souls of platforming games.
The Dark Souls are trying to nail that first jump and falling down the hill. I feel like I love all of those trilogies. I don't know.
Spyro is amazing though.
It is. I mean, the thing is, like, Spyro 3 has the same problem that Crash 3 has, where it's like different characters. It's probably not different characters in Spyro's case, but just mini game, you know, gameplay differentiations that a lot of people didn't like.
The trajectory of Spyro and Crash, they're kind of similar, really, aren't they? Because it's like they both went into, like you said, the very mini gamey territory with their third game, and their second games are widely regarded as being their best. So
I will say that like all three of those Tomb Raider games blur into one in my head. Like I remember specific levels, but I couldn't tell you which level was in 2 or 3 at this point.
Tomb Raider 1 was like hauntingly good. I could play through the entire first 3 stages in my mind to this day, moment to moment, room to room. They are that deeply embedded because I played it that much. But I won't say that Tomb Raider 2 and 3 were actually important in my personal gaming journey. However, Crash and Spyro definitely were. And I adored Gex Enter the Gecko. I believe that was the second one. Yeah. With him like as the spy on the front cover.
Yes.
Like the James Bond riff. That was an amazing game. That, to me, that one game is actually better than potentially some of Spyro and Crash's other games. But as a trilogy overall, I can't recommend it because... Gex 1 definitely had its flaws. Gex 3, I can't remember which one that actually was. Maybe I'm getting
Gex 3D
confused.
Is one of them as well, I think. It's been so long since I've thought about Gex.
Oh, maybe I'm getting confused with Gex being a 2D game first, and Gex 3D Enter the Gecko was the one that I remember being the best one.
Yeah,
But either way, that was such a phenomenally good game. It's just weird because our relationship with Gex is totally different to America's version with it, because we had Leslie Phillips, I believe.
I don't know the specifics other than
you'll know him as a voice actor because he's the guy who's like, oh, ding dong.
Oh, right. Okay.
Like, yeah, I think he was he was the voice actor for Gex in the UK, and they got some absolute jobber out in the US to do. He was like a comedian, like a stand-up comedian, and people were like, oh, he's so funny, he's so funny. And I went and listened to like the clips of this. It's aggravating, teeth-pullingly bad, because it's like, this reminds me of like a night at Mel Gibson's house. And it's like, what is this? And then you've got the suave and smarmy almost Gex that we got, and then this absolute jokester for the US market.
The thing is, like, Gex just didn't stay popular. I loved that game at the time, Enter the Gecko, mainly because at the time it was a big deal that a game would reference anything in pop culture. So it was like, oh my god, I can't believe they're channeling this stuff. For me though, I feel like Crash and Spyro are like a tier above. Like, nothing against Tomb Raider. I loved the Tomb Raider, but it's mostly the first one. And then maybe, I guess, Tomb Raider 2. 3 I didn't finish back in the day, so I can't.
And that's
like
the thing,
for
it's one of those things where I know it reviewed well. I know the people who really liked Tomb Raider absolutely loved it, but just it wasn't for me. I'm going to go with, if you go for Crash, I'll go for Spyro then at least we're covering our bases.
I think it also, I mean, the thing is, like, Spyro has a skateboard. If Crash had a skateboard, maybe
a hoverboard with the surfboard as
well. Yeah, oh my god, the Hang 8 stuff. It's pretty good. We have the most us question next, then the most us question ever asked from David Steed, who says, what's a good place to start with with turn-based combat games. I've always been scared off by the complexity slash strategic elements, but both your enthusiasm has made me want to try them. Been enjoying the EBP since it started, so thank you both for all the great listens. Well, thank you very much for sticking with us the whole time.
Yeah, cheers. I appreciate that. Yeah. The answer to that is there's too many good ones.
Thing is, a turn-based combat game, are you then going down like a grid-based XCOM-y approach?
Right, I think that turn-based, we've got to separate out, like you say, because if it's turn-based, then we just think, oh, it's like Final Fantasy VI. Like, that is a turn-based combat
system.
You said
7 wrong there, but...
Six is good. Well, six is very good, mate. We'll put a pin in that. The turn-based game, though, I guess would be everything is turn-based, so we do look for the XCOM stuff. So ones that we can definitely recommend, XCOM. Mm-hmm. I'd say that Marvel Midnight Suns is a turn-based combat game because it's card-based. It's not necessarily grid-based, but it's turn-based, and I absolutely adore that
The
game.
Way Midnight Suns makes you think is quintessential to the strategic side of it. Yeah, yeah. Also, for XCOM, I'd say Enemy Within, like the second one. Yeah. Not Enemy Unknown, Enemy Within.
The Enemy Within is the one which had the Wrath of the Chosen, War of the Chosen expansion, wasn't it?
That's XCOM 2?
Oh, XCOM 2. Okay, so I'm going to go for XCOM 2. Yeah. XCOM 2, because I genuinely think that is my favourite hex-based game ever. I genuinely think that is such a brilliant step up. It's so pressured, it's so time-sensitive, and it's so bloody difficult as well.
Yeah, 2 is lush. I think for me, it was like remembering like what got me in. It was like the initial XCOM, the 2012 one, and then when they did the expansion that was meant to be a sequel, but they put it out as like DLC instead, and I'm sure it's called Enemy Within, and so they brought in all the mechs, and it was
that was amazing. Where you could hide behind your own mech guys.
Yes.
That
was
amazing fun.
And it's like, I think that is sometimes a little bit easier to get the grip with an XCOM 2, but you can't go wrong. Like, either of those depends on what you can get access to.
You could go way back way and play like Final Fantasy Tactics, because that's obviously got the Final Fantasy branding. It's got a really rich storyline and an incredibly deep battle system. You've got your Fire Emblem games as well, which obviously go for the turn-based and hex-based stuff. You could maybe even go back to, do you remember a game called Kessen?
Good lord, yes.
Dynasty Warriors Tactics. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah, yeah. It's basically like the same sort of thing.
Kessen
was
a PS2 thing. I remember that. I was going to say Triangle Strategy is actually phenomenal from last year. If you want something with more of a story-based, like a story edge to it, that's very Game of Thrones-y in terms of like power structures and battles between these different families and areas and things like that, if you want to add that to it. But that's still a grid-based strategy game. But yeah, I think overall we'd probably just both say XCOM, either Enemy Within or XCOM 2.
It's one of those things where it is so challenging, though. Is it going to put off people who are just dipping their toe in? Because it's like a game that does not hold your hand, and it will punish you the moment that you try and think, oh, okay, I need a bit of time to
think.
That
was definitely
why
I kind of bounced off 2. Like, I never finished 2. And so I guess I would say Enemy Within or the original XCOM Enemy Unknown from 2012. Like, I know there's an original like 2D one, but the remake.
Yeah, I had that one. That's brutal, man. That's like if you thought that the remakes were hard, in this one here, your first mission is always the same thing. You have 10 guys, all have guile, sporting big flat tops. They walk out of the plane. They can't see the enemy because there's fog of war across the map. You get shot from off screen. It's alien weaponry against your underleveled guys. They die immediately. Game over. Oh, fantastic.
Actually, that's the thing. If someone's getting into this from scratch, do you play with permadeath? Because I used to, and then I would always, like, because if you have permadeath, then you've ranked up a soldier for like 5 hours and they die and you never get them back. And you're supposed to feel that.
You want
to
win. But... you want to win, though. It's weird because I feel like permadeath should be like your second playthrough. Like your first playthrough, you should just get through and just win and cheat and do whatever you can, but then really challenge yourself the next time. I'd say that if you want a balance between difficulty, accessibility, and out and out fun and gore and silliness, I would maybe suggest going for the Warhammer 40k Chaos Hunters Demon Hunters, Chaos Gate, I think that's what it's called. It came out last year, and it was my one of my Game of the Years. I thought it was brilliant because it takes all of the XCOM formula, like the grid-based stuff, but it removes chance to hit. You don't have to do a percentage to hit. You do always hit because you're Space Marines and you're trained to be the best of the best, but you just do less damage the further you are from your opponent, and I liked that as a compromise.
I was going to say, when you're getting into XCOM, even if you have a 99% chance to hit, you'll probably still miss. Like, there's always that thing where you'll just get dicked on.
Weirdly enough, though, I was reading about this. That is one of gaming's greatest fallacies, that is. That 99% chance to hit thing, apparently, it doesn't miss. Somebody told me that the whole idea of, like, yes, there is a 99% chance to hit, and people have said, oh, you could have that and fail. But apparently, it doesn't. It's only on lower percentages than that. Like, it will nearly...
Well, we've definitely experienced it where like really high percentages have missed. I've had a 90%
shot. Yeah, but
shot
not miss but not 99%.
No, 90% I guess
not. Or something like that. Yeah. So I was like, interesting. Might as well just debunk that now. Well,
yeah, I think if there's like there'll hopefully be a spot where you'll definitely nail a shot, but it just feels like in XCOM you can just get things can go wrong.
Oh, you can get dicked over in an instant, and it is not fun in the slightest. And speaking of things that you do not like when playing video games, let's move over to HBadder_97, what a username, over on Instagram, who said, "What up, legends? Love the UBP. Thank you very much. What is an instant turn-off when playing a game? As in, what will turn you off a game quicker than anything else?"
I'm just thinking of what my mind serves up when you ask that. Stuff where it pops up and asks me to log in to a company-specific account. When Bethesda put that stuff in the Doom... when they re-released Doom on the Switch, and it would just pop up and be like, "You haven't logged into your Bethesda.net account." And
that
it was just
sucked.
Like, I don't want this. And like Ubisoft, but you got to log into the Ubi Play or whatever. Or EA wants you to log into something.
And if you didn't do that, they'd give you adverts, wouldn't they?
Because
it was like, hey, if you do log in, you'll get a 10% experience boost for the next 20 hours. And it's like, oh, dude, and it's like, let me play the game.
And it's like, there's the first thing. That's the thing. Like terms and conditions, when you first boot a game up, you'll scroll through all of them. And then maybe they want you to connect your account or whatever. And then something like 2K, it's just like, you've got to load like an internet window inside the game to fill it all out.
It looks horrible. Horrible, doesn't it? Yeah.
And you're like typing out your email with the game keyboard. Like, I'm just like, nah, man. I can't think. There was something I played, it was last year, that opened like that. And I turned it off. I was like, I don't even care enough about this. And it was something that just didn't have much going for it anyway. And it's full on just made me go like, no.
They've just done that with Blood Bowl 3 that's just dropped. You go into the game and it gives you two options, either log on to go online or you go offline. And if you go offline, it treats you like you're a piece of scum, because it's just like, if you go offline, you can't trade anything else. You can't interact with online players. You can't do this, you can't do that, and blah, 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 blah. And all XP will not mean anything in the greater scheme. And you're like, oh, that's a bit cold, isn't it? Can I just play an offline game for fun, thanks?
Yeah, literally. And it's just that whole idea of something being online that has all these different things that are plugged into you, like being turned off at some point or whatever.
We should say as well, anything that's got live service nowadays, I honestly am completely turned off from that, because Scott and I actually, just before we filmed this, have just done a news video on the state of the Suicide Squad, state of it, mate. And we basically were just there like, it's become a live service game. And I think that you as an audience member listening to this knows exactly what I mean when I say it's a live service game. It's a homogenous piece of slop that tastes like every other bit of gruel that you're being shoveled down your pipes at the moment.
Yeah, we would recommend our news video as our almost immediate reactions to the footage that were shown during the State of Play. Yeah. And we might get back around to Suicide Squad, because people have been asking about that and what it means for the state of AAA games and everything else. But that'll be one of my biggest turnoffs, is when a game is just won't let me play it. I was playing through Atomic Heart last night, and I'd only done the first sort of couple hours, but that game...
Oh, weirdly enough, I actually had a question lined up for I played Atomic Heart. So RKelly141, you have just... Oh, R. Kelly, really? You've chosen that as your username?
That's not what
Kelly?
You want,
that's not a good time. No. But yes, you're saying played Atomic Heart. Yes, Scott has.
Yeah, I dove into it last night. I started it a couple of days ago, and then I tried playing it. I stayed up to try and play it at midnight, and then just fell asleep as soon as it finally installed. So I went back to it last night. I've done the opening sort of 2-3 hours. That game gets in its own way constantly. Like, you barely play anything in the first couple hours. It's constantly on rails, it's constantly story based. The dialogue is terrible, the writing is pretty bad.
I'm really upset about that, because I'm actually looking forward to playing it. I haven't played it yet. I'm like waiting to get through my Resident Evil 2 speed run that I'm doing.
It's a weird one.
Dice, and I want to just get it done.
Right. Yeah, you have a lot more fun with RE2 than you will with this. I ended up just tapping out on it eventually. But the thing is, like, it's a weird thing. Obviously right now there's still a lot of stuff being done around the conversation that it is very pro Russia. Like, there's a lot of stuff going on in regards to things the developers have put in there that seem to be targeted at Ukraine. So I don't pick up on all of them.
Weren't they like making this game years and years before this, that there's no way you could have predicted a Russo-Ukrainian conflict at this point in time? I'm not trying to defend the developers, but this stuff does happen where world events happen outside of game dev release. But I guess at the same time, if you are making something, you do have the option to switch and change stuff around. It would be pretty hard though when your entire game is set in Russia, though.
So that's the thing. Like, I've not played enough. I don't know enough of Russian culture, Ukrainian culture, the history of those countries, movies, whatever, to pick up on most stuff as the layman. But it was just what some people were sharing online, going like, oh my God, there's this photo is in the game and this represents this and whatever. I haven't seen certain things like that myself yet, nor would I necessarily get the full context of it. But that's just to say that that is out there. But even still, as a video game, I think that it drags its arse for about two and a half hours, just lots of on-rails stuff, lots of preamble. The opening sequence is incredibly impressive as a feat of coding, considering the team size. And at the beginning, I was like, oh my God, if you just told me this was the next Bioshock, I'd probably just buy it. It's just outside of the voice acting, just in terms of the way that the world is framed. And there's a lot of really cool, like, original machines and, like, the way that they frame this idea of a Soviet victory coming out of World War II and what would happen from that. All that stuff is fascinating to look at. The art direction is very strong. It's just that the dialogue is terrible. And the level layouts are just so boring, where it's just like, go all the way over here, get a key, go back, fight like two dudes. Like, the combat's nice and chunky. But there's not, for me so far, there's hardly been any of it. So I played quite a bit last night, and then I had to like open a door. There was a lever somewhere. I could see it in a vision mode. It was in a different room. And I was running around trying to find this switch. I finally found it.
I have heard that the busy work is insane. Like, having to open doors that require balls of energy, and you've got to go get four balls. And the protagonist even says, like, who would desire, I'm gonna do him like a Brooklyn accent, because let's face it, he's just an American, isn't he? And it's weird,
he's like generic
to be this
American.
He's like, hey yo, this door opens but only if I put my balls into
it.
But he says that, and it's like, it's meant to excuse bad game design. Like, making people aware of bad game design is not a good idea, because like, people just go, yeah, okay, you've said that this is a stupid way to play this game, but why are you then making me do it?
Yeah, which is one of the most outdated, like, way, like a get out. It's like, oh, if we just acknowledge it, then we can do a fetch quest, we can do 50 things. It was just the level design that put me off, because like, the way that they advertised it, I don't know if you saw the advert, there was a recent video advert or whatever starring Jensen Ackles.
And
where it just seemed like it was more like a Doom or a Wolfenstein, like more of a full-on just like swiping through all these different robots.
Yeah, they really did push like that it was going to be an action heavy set piece thing, and not a collectathon style thing that you were
And it's not necessarily a collectathon, but it is very slow. Like, it's just very slow. And it's like, they set up this sort of action premise when things all kick off in the intro. It's like, right, finally I'm going to get to chew through all these robots. And you just don't. It's got like stealth mechanics. It's got like all this weird level layout where you're just trying to find a key to get through the next door. And maybe it opens up in time. It does look absolutely gorgeous. That's the thing. I do think it's incredible as a feat of coding for this team. I think it's their first game. And obviously it's been in development for a long time. And I know that they did have other plans for multiplayer that got shaved down and everything. So I think that side of it is impressive if you can separate it. But I'm not having fun with the actual story, the writing, what I'm doing moment to moment. And after a while, I was just like, I am just wasting my life going between these rooms trying to find this key.
That's never a good feeling.
To go to the next room. For this general setup that I don't even really care about what's happening. And yeah, there's a whole thing with like Russian agents and German agents, but they're all voiced like Americans, so it's, that stuff is jarring as hell as
I don't like that, don't like that at all. Like, I know that they have given you the option to play with the original Russian language and stuff like that, or original languages, which I think that I would just have that as a,
I try to find that in the that must be in the main menu, that wasn't in the pause menu.
If
I can switch it, then cool. But yeah, I was looking forward to this game. Like, obviously we didn't know that much about it across most of this year. It just looked like a cool Bioshocky type thing. And hopefully it gets there, but I don't know if I'm going to play that much more of it. It was just such a slog. And I think there's something about being offered up something so potentially beautiful in regards to the architecture, the art direction, and then it just dragging and dragging and dragging, and then being like, oh, this is just all show and nothing else. It's all just glitz and nothing else. So
that's a shame.
I mean, whatever. Like, the reviews are all over the place. Some people giving it 9s and 10s. Some people giving it 4. So
yeah, I remember IGN gave it 8 out of 10, and I was like, interesting. Okay, fair enough.
Yes.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Next question from Rhino, who says, with Shinji Mikami having left Tango Gameworks, do you think moving away from the horror games that he pioneered has caused his departure? I don't think so, but...
What do they mean? Caused his departure, as in, like, because it's not a horror game that he didn't enjoy working on Hi-Fi?
Well, I guess that's the assumption that, like, yeah, Hi-Fi Rush was their most recent game, and he wasn't brought on board after it was in motion or something. So I don't think
Mikami's known for much more than doing just horror games. Mm. Like, he works on very exuberant projects. Like, I think he works like in the same way that Platinum Game Studios used to work. That sort of like over the top. Point me in a direction, I will take it to its ridiculous extreme, like kind of Yoko Taro for Nier Automata, Potato Potato. It's just like they're one of those auteur directors that just goes, here is a concept that may be very traditional, let's expand it and do something very silly and strange with it. So,
well, he perfected that stuff.
It was a bit of a shame to see him go, though, because I was excited to see how well Hi-Fi was doing and thinking, okay, where could things go from here for him and the studio at large? But losing that kind of implies that it's like, yep, I'm a one and done, contractually obliged, let's go on to the next one.
Maybe. I wonder, because the thing is, like, inside Hi-Fi Rush is like a teaser for the next Evil Within. So it's like the assumption was that he would be wanting to do that, and they've got more, assumedly they've got more budget than ever because they're with Xbox. So I don't know. Like, I mean, I feel like he would only leave to do something of his own. Maybe he's just sick of that level of production. I mean, it would grind you down. He's been at that level of production for a long time, and even going to Tango from Capcom was like a step down to try and start again and get that spark back and whatever. But I wonder what... I mean, the thing, he's clearly got so many ideas, he might as well break off and do something smaller again.
Yeah, I always think to myself how it must be to be a video game creator in a world where Hideo Kojima it also exists in. I feel like that man casts a very large shadow over most of the gaming industry, with people constantly referencing back to the freedoms that he was given, the money that he was always had available to him, and the people he was allowed to work with. And some would say unfairly so, because it's kind of like, did he deserve to have all of this fame and the success when it's not just one person but an entire team that makes your reality come to life? And it's like, if I was a video game creator at that level in the same sphere as him, there would always be that sense of jealousy of thinking, like, how can one person be given everything and produce something like Death Stranding that was so utterly divisive, and yet you deliver something like Hi-Fi Rush, which is universally acclaimed at this point, had a beautifully marketed campaign to just do the shadow drop. It's here, a huge success, and yet you're not working with the same constraints or
that's a good point. Like, it's not like anyone's holding him up, like, oh my god, you know, Shinji Mikami. Like, I guess that's the thing, he was brought on like during development, because when they announced it, he was part of that Shadow Drop video, but it was a different wing of the company, and then he sort of helped it get over the finish line.
It's weird, isn't it, because you think to yourself, it's almost like he was brought in as a kind of, and here is Shinji Mikami.
It's not like
Shinji Mikami is the focus. He is designing a new game. Here it is, blah, 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 blah. And that may not be the case. It may, like you say, because he came in too late into the project and just saw it over the finish line. But it's weird how some game creators or directors are put front and center as the big marketing sell, and others are just kind of like, oh, well, I'm also here, I guess. Everyone's got their different like opinions in terms of, like, he might not want to be the star of the show, but I do find it interesting.
Totally. Well, the thing is, like, that is fascinating, because when you think about the amount of worlds that Mikami has birthed or helped shape, like Devil May Cry, Vanquish, and then being able to do Evil Within and helping on Hi-Fi Rush, he has birthed more stuff than Kojima has, like, in terms of like a ground up universe kind of thing. Obviously, Kojima's just done, he's pretty much just done five different worlds, but within Metal Gear. But still, Mikami should be up there more. And he is to people like us, but, like, I mean, I don't know if the average person would recognize Hideo Kojima as a name, but I feel like more people would know Kojima as opposed to Shinji Mikami, even though, like you said, they both largely operate in the same way. Like, Mikami is an auteur, has been for so long.
Like, Shinji Mikami has released so many games of different qualities and styles that I'd say that overall he is the better director. If we're putting the two comparisons, I know that he obviously Hideo Kojima is a huge, huge soft spot for you, but I just think in terms of having as many different successful projects, like the guy may helped make Vanquish. It's one of my favorite games. That, like, and it's still so underappreciated even to this day.
Well, I'm still just like running his stuff down. It's like the original Resident Evil. He was the director on. He also directed the original Dino Crisis.
Like, imagine being that person to spearhead Resident Evil. That is insane, man.
That's the thing. And it's like, over the years, obviously little things like Beautiful Joe, where he's an executive producer. You're one of your favorite games, God Hand, he directed that. Vanquish, Shadows of the Damned.
He was part of Clover for a while, wasn't he? Clover Studios.
And it's just, that's the thing. And it's like, even something like Ghostwire Tokyo, he's just listed as executive producer for that. But I feel like Ghostwire still had a really lovely like approach to it. Like, I love the art direction in that game. I wanted to love that game. It was just the way that it was so generic once you actually spent more time in it. But
it just came and went, didn't it? And it was just kind of like, cool, great to look at, not that fun to play.
No, that was like another, I guess, Suicide Squad-y type thing where they just went down a really safe route in regards to the gameplay.
Let's go back over to Instagram and go to Lord Golder, who says, what is the best things that a sequel can do? I love it when they reward you for doing well in the previous game. That is a great shout. Not enough games actually carry over progress, save states, and choices that you made in the previous game. Some of them just go like, you made this choice. Canonically, this was the choice that was made.
That's
you got
true.
The best ending or the worst ending. And I do love it when you get interconnected games because Mass Effect 2, great example of that. Some of the choices that you made in that carried over, and it was a pleasure to get emails from people that you helped or didn't help in the previous game, or characters remembering you going like, well, you didn't like it when we did this back on that planet. It's like, oh, that's cool. I like that.
No, same. I'm always, they don't do it anymore. Like, talk about like a thing that like, because I guess it would be a much bigger deal for a team to embark on, okay, this is going to be three games. Because right now in the modern day, you wouldn't be able to guarantee those three games. And I guess that in Mass Effect's case, it was just sort of, they kept going. I think it was always planned as a trilogy, but that idea of doing that now is something that's rarer. I was going to fold in Nelson Fowler's question because that's also about sequels. Tweeted in saying that I'd said God of War Ragnarok was just fine because it didn't really expand gameplay in a meaningful way. So in both of our opinions, what direct video game sequels expand on their predecessors' gameplay the best? I think that's like a way of rolling that in of like, what should a sequel do, or what are the best sequels do? Because my mind goes to Devil May Cry 3. I feel like that was like such a huge step up from DMC 1 and 2. 2 was like a weird experiment that didn't work and whatever. But then 3 was just like, okay, you can, you know, there's so many moves you have access to and so many different ways you can engage with combat. But yeah, in terms of like that idea of what carries over, I don't know, I like sequels that carry on where the first one left off in terms of a gameplay mentality. Like, if you've played the original one, where all those different animations and responsiveness and everything is like in you, like it's almost like, you know, you're thinking
you've
in a way.
You've those skills and you don't need to relearn them, sort of thing.
And so like one of my favorite sequels is Hotline Miami 2, which I know a lot of people didn't like because it's such a hard game from moment one. But if you've caned the living hell out of Hotline Miami 1, then 2 just literally carries on where that left off. And it is more of a reliance on guns rather than melee, which is like one of the biggest like identifiers parts of it. But I like that I could just go straight into 2 and be challenged from level 1. That is a conversation in itself, because like a lot of people will just pick up sequels, but I don't know, for me, I always end up going back and trying to get the original of a thing anyway. I don't know if you always do that, but
it's interesting because there's a lot of people, game developers say that the making a sequel seems like it's a sure thing on paper, but the problem is that you are at that point, you've got notoriety around your game. Usually when a sequel comes out, people at least know of the original game's existence, but you have to assume for the most part that they haven't played it. And I was like, what a weird way to think about things, that you're making a sequel but you have to make it so that anyone can pick it
up. That stupid
Whereas
thing.
I know that if I made a game and I made a sequel, I probably would continue things on, because that's the way I would, as a author or a director, see it. But for the casual gamer, if they picked it up and was like, well, how do I do half of the moves, and this game isn't teaching me in a fresh and interesting way that I can't get up to speed quick enough, then you actually lose a lot of interest straight out of the gate. So you end up with sequels that go, hey, remember the original game? Here's the start of it again.
Yeah, here's like, the recap thing. It's because I think of it like, I think of game sequels like movie sequels. So it's like, it's fundamentally continuing the story. So I should watch the original one. But I wonder if as an industry, they think of it more like a second product. It's like, it's another one of them. And yeah. so we're just going to, you know, we're going to do the gameplay mechanics again and do it that way. But yeah, I feel like there are all like different ways to approach it. But like when you mentioned Mass Effect before, I remember when Mass Effect 3 was coming out and EA were just, there was a whole advertising campaign about it, Mass Effect 3 being the perfect place to start. And it was like, yes. there's no way that you could just watch, like, you couldn't just watch Return of the King and just get the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Like, it doesn't yeah. work that way.
It was like, I remember the opening based on that because I obviously was like, okay, let's scrutinize this and judge it as if I was a brand new player coming into Mass Effect 3. And that opening section with Shepard and the Reaper attacking and then you basically just escaping, you see the child potentially die. Yeah. You're just kind of like, okay, I do understand that you're setting up a big evil, but if I was a newcomer coming in, I'd be like, whoa, this is moving a million miles yeah. a second. I do not understand why this giant thing is attacking or what it meant to be. Mm-hmm. Why are people so afraid? Like, what is going on here?
And it's like, if you just came into Mass Effect 3 straight away, it would feel like a weird sort of B-movie. It would just literally be like, alien invasion, go stop it. And I guess you have this crew that, you know, clearly
it
like
It would be mentally. Lesser with your lack of understanding because you'd just be like, this is just a generic alien attack. What's going on?
Next question from Daron Garcia, who says, love the podcast, listen every week, first time asking a question. I hate what Warner Brothers games have forced Rocksteady to do at the last state of play. It's the only logical explanation I can think of. What's the worst example of publisher interference that you can think of? I also want to roll in Nate the Gamer's question, who says, when was the last time you played a AAA game that was unique? It's a harder question than you think.
And it does suck, especially when you see that the studio is basically just effectively being curtailed by the standards and expectations of the video game market. Mm-hmm. Scott said in our previous video that we put out on the news on the Suicide Squad reactions that it stinks of a game from 2017. And therefore, it's a case of it had 2017 mechanics and mentalities. And then as it got longer in the gestation period and the budget went higher and higher and higher, they were like, oh God, we have to make our money back somehow. How do you make money back now? Loot boxes are out by this point. live service stuff.
Go. Yeah. I think, that idea, worst example of publisher interference you can think of. Do you remember Fuse? It was the game that Insomniac did with EA.
Do you remember Fuse?
It was it was years ago. It was like a four-person, it was a single-player game, but you could switch between a whole squad, little bit like Brute Force. And Insomniac
What a game, eh? I know. I referenced that.
What a pull. I love that little dinosaur dude that you could play as in Brute Force.
Yeah, he's great. Brutus.
I remember that dude, just the look of him. So Insomniac did a game with EA called Fuse, and they did it Insomniac style, where it was like lots of cartoony characters and whatever. It was like a four-player squad thing. And then EA were like, this isn't going to sell. Make it military. And then if you look at the before and after of what Fuse started as and what it released as, and the release date version of it is kind of like that old Fracture game. It's just sort of like generic space marine kind of stuff. And it was like the biggest bomb of like Insomniac's career or whatever. So that would be mine, where they literally overhauled it because it was just like, no one wants this. Make it like everything else.
Yeah, I feel like there's so many games that have that, don't they, where they have a great idea in principle, and then somebody just goes along and says, that won't sell, that won't make it to the mainstream, mate. People don't want to do X, people don't want to do Y. Another example is Payday 2. So when it was bought out by, I think Starbreeze Studios is the one that bought it off the original publishing house or development team, they then said, cool, right, we've got it now. Who likes microtransactions? And everyone went, no, we don't like microtransactions. And then a week or a month later, they said, hey, you know what people don't like? Having microtransactions, so let's get them out of the game.
Oh,
so
really?
That nearly killed Payday 2. And I thought that it was near impossible to do that because that game is still enduring as like one of the more popular games on Steam.
Stuff like that where they go, like, oh, is this it? Is this the thing you want? And everyone goes, dear God, no. And they go, oh, sorry.
Why would you add it in like 10 years after the game release as well? That is just bizarre, man.
That's their attempt at sort of like trying to make everything into a live service. It's like, well, we've got a fan base. We can monetize the living hell out of them. Let's try that.
We have loyal customers. Let's scalp them.
Like, yeah, let's just sort of like mine the love and get the money out. I feel like Nate the Gamer's question about when was the last time you played a AAA game that was unique. I guess unique gameplay is few and far between. It tends to be, for me, it's more unique thematics. Like I loved God of War Ragnarok's depiction of fatherhood. I think that's like more unique. I think Horizon, the 2017 game, like obviously the way that universe was like born, like the amount of detail it's put into it. I think like that whole idea of a robotic apocalypse and robotic dinosaurs and stuff, that's a really like unique idea too.
Yeah, it's weird because once you boil down AAA games into their core essentials, what are they doing new? Like, I guess that Demon's Souls was probably the last one that I can think of that took a core concept and then added the ridiculously hard challenge aspect to it, which elevated that entire thing. I'd say that Breath of the Wild at least it innovated within its own genre, sorry, its own franchise to adapt a new genre to it. Mm-hmm. But if you take all of these things away, none of them are new. Like, they're all new to the franchise.
If you're looking for a new gameplay mechanic, it's very few and far between. I think also, like, the idea of, Red Dead Redemption 2 was very unique. Like, that was a very, like, belabored approach
Was it unique, though? It was unique in the sense that it had a lot of detail, but mm-hmm. it wasn't a unique game. It was just a third person Western. Like, it didn't do anything different with that concept.
I would say that you're right. Like, the core mechanics are still a third person shooter. You're still taking cover. Mm-hmm. You're still, like, doing those things. But I feel like Red Dead Redemption 2 to me feels like an indie game with a AAA game with an indie soul. Like, it's all mm-hmm. like, we're going to take our time. We're going to make you really feel like you're struggling through the Old West. And I feel like that was something that really stood out. So I would say that Red Dead Redemption 2 has more unique aspects to it in regards to framing those thematics. You really do feel like you're playing the death of the Old West. Like, it's so
because it's the life sim, effectively, at that
point. Yeah, literally, all the social aspects to it.
It was weird because when I was doing the research for the list that I wrote yesterday, the tiny ways that video games blew your mind without realizing, mm-hmm. I was looking into indie development versus AAA development because it mm-hmm. just ended up on like a big thread of indie devs talking about what they did and didn't do to get things working. Mm-hmm. And they showed this diagram that had loads of different aspects of key features that AAA games look to achieve. And it was a widespread that was evenly fixed amongst them. So it was like graphics, gameplay, DLC, monetization, mm-hmm. sequel bait, blah, blah, blah. And then it showed what a AAA indie game or III game looks like. Mm-hmm. And it was all of those things, but they were minimized but equal. And one aspect was just like shooting off into the distance, which was one new mechanic done well. And I was like, yeah, that is actually what indie games are. They're basically just like, what if this platformer had a time rewinding mechanic? What if this racing game had the ability to flip the entire gravity upside down? Like, that's what they do.
And which is what the industry used to be. Like, especially in the 2000s, it was like, you're one cool mechanic. We've long said on the podcast that, like, if you want, you know, a variety of game mechanics, it's in the indie space. It's not in the AAA space.
But because AAA, they do lots of new mechanics. They do lots of features. They have to have everything all at once, all the time. And it's like, okay, like, that's great and all, mm-hmm. but you do end up feeling almost overwhelmed by what is actually new and what have you borrowed. Mm-hmm. Because it's like Ubisoft, as much as they're in hot water at the moment, for many, many reasons, they at least adopted the Ubisoft formula to have, it's a generic game with one facet that we're going to push, Black Flag, with the entire depth of it going into the naval combat system, mm-hmm. was an inspired choice. Mm-hmm. But not many games do that, where they just focus on the one thing.
Like, I feel like Sony are in a position exactly like that right now, where you get like almost the same game over and over again. It's always a third person over the shoulder kind of camera, mild loot components, open world, and then they change one little thing in there. So whether that is, you know, the Ghost of Tsushima, the combat model was the thing that they tweaked mm-hmm. in there. Obviously, there's little things like the way that the wind guides you to the different missions that you go to, but it largely plays the same way as something like The Last of Us Part 2 or whatever, which largely plays the same way as a God of War in terms of the way you mm-hmm. explore that world, and then you change the combat model for God of War. But if you just took a screenshot of it, of a character walking forward, they would all look the same. It's just that it changes in terms of the combat model, but that's largely it. Like, you're largely playing them the same way. It's not like Sony are putting out a first-person shooter or a really high-fidelity platformer where you're kicking off the walls and air-dashing and doing whatever. They just don't do that stuff anymore.
It was quite funny, wasn't it? Because obviously with the state of play we had yesterday, it was all of the PSVR 2 games that came out. And I was like scanning through them and I was like, oh, it's a first-person shooter.
I know.
It's like, cool. So that's going to be where you get your first-person shooter fix from. And I understand why, because it is a first-person perspective headset. It is immersive. It is the easiest way to envelop people in. There was only one game in there that stood out to me, and that was Don't Close Your Eyes or whatever it's called.
Before Your Eyes, I think it's called.
Before Your Eyes, that's it, And I was like, cool, we've already seen this game, but now getting to actually look around the space and it reading your actual blinking movements, I was like, okay, that's a nice use of the PSVR 2.
Yeah, that seems cool. I think as well, that was my thing watching that that rollout, because Josh has got the PSVR 2. I need to mine him for info when he's back next week. That whole thing, that was my thing. I'm looking at the footage of the games that are coming out, and I'm just like, this just looks like I could play it on a regular controller. And I know that I can't. I know there's more fidelity to the motion and everything. But it's not like we're getting a Sony first-party first-person shooter. It's not like they're doing...
No.
You know, the last time they tried that was Killzone, and it absolutely bombed. So like, they just haven't bothered.
didn't they release a little special gun for one of them, the Zapper or something?
Oh,
like that?
God, yeah.
And there was a game that was like, it was like, you're going to revolutionize the way you play first-person shooters on the PSVR. And then it's like, it's just for this one game and no other game uses it. Fantastic. Oh.
And all that was like, you were just slotting the two Move controllers into one little framework. Right? It looked terrible anyway. Final question from Mr. J, who says, good afternoon, you pair of legends. Who is the greatest Smash Brothers character and why is it Kirby? The little pink blob is an absolute god.
This again. I hate the fact we haven't talked about Smash Brothers in a long time. I just don't like the fact that Sakurai just believes that Kirby is some sort of badass that can take on anyone. So therefore, he gives his character that he created the skills to become the best Smash Bros. It's like, you're going up against people who are like trained killers, evil, that could dominate the entire universe. And you're just saying, oh no, this Kirby kicks his ass. Kicks his ass, mate. Kicks his ass. It's like, nah.
He would eat that universe. I think for me, if I'm going the best Smash Brothers character to literally just use, I really love Little Mac.
I was about to say, I find him so much fun because it's like, bam!
All the combos are great. His like his bulk up, that big like mutated version of him is awesome. I guess like I think like Ryu and Kazuya are awesome as well.
But you're just choosing the fighting game fighters.
I like
really,
my fighting game dudes.
I think that, well, I mean, you've got a lot of Fire Emblem characters to choose from, but I don't really rate many of them. I'd say that my favorite character to play as would be Bowser or King K. Rool, because I kind of like my big heavies, and I do like the fact that you've got some very fun moves, like the up and then downward smash with Bowser's butt smash is so funny to pull off. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you'll never beat the absolute meme lord that is Falcon Punch! Like, that is there for a reason. It Captain is a good Falcon. Laugh. Whenever you connect with that, whoa!
Yeah, Captain Falcon ticks my fighting game box as well.
Because is Paul in Smash?
No,
yet?
Sadly not.
Because they need to have like the big sort of like Falcon punch versus the punch that he's
break
got.
The screen. I think they've finished ultimate stuff now. But I'll shout out Sephiroth as well. I think his combos are awesome. But yes, for now, a massive, massive thank you to everybody for sending in their various questions for the UBP, I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Jules Gill.
I have indeed, and remember, you can go check out our social medias every Thursday for the
Call for the Questions,
where we will be asking for your questions, be they gaming related, be they film, TV, food, or otherwise. You can follow Scott over on Twitter at /LP89, and you can follow me over on Instagram at RetroJ, but the O is a zero, baby.
Beautiful. Once again, thank you very much, and we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.